Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case this morning is the Trustees versus Carr, or Dar, rather.
Peck. Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Robert Peck. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Lanny Dar. This matter began in state court for attorney's fees under the Common Fund Doctrine. It's only a state law issue and a type of cause of action that the Supreme Court in Mackey described as run-of-the-mill, not within ERISA as this Court's precedents indicate. The trustees believed that they would lose in state court and conceived that they had no grounds for removal to federal court. But they sought and received an injunction and later attorney's fees in the federal court. One of the errors in the trial court is that it treated Mr. Dar as the attorney for a beneficiary as the alter ego for that beneficiary. This Court's precedents, largely over removal, such as Blackburn, Primax, and Varco, all make clear that the attorney and beneficiary do not stand in the same shoes. And the grounds on which the federal court took jurisdiction was over conflict preemption. But as we know from this Court's precedents, conflict preemption should be asserted in state court and adjudicated there. State courts are fully competent to resolve those issues. And the state court also relied on Section 1132A3, which allows for injunctions against practices and acts that either violate the ERISA statute or otherwise violate the plan. It's hard for the attorney who is not a party for the plan to violate that plan, and so therefore we think that that was misguided as well. As I said, Mr. Dar was not a party to the plan. He signed as counsel for Miller in order for Miller to receive the benefits that he was due as a beneficiary.
But, of course, Mr. Dar did sign a subrogation agreement with the carpenter saying he wouldn't do exactly what he then turned around and did.
The agreement did not obligate him not to charge attorney's fees. Well, it simply notified the beneficiary that the plan itself was not obligated to pay attorney's fees, but it didn't indicate that they were prohibited from doing so.
He says that he assigned any and all proceeds that he might receive without any deduction whatsoever from any third party, and he would not do anything which would in any way prejudice or jeopardize the rights of the fund.
That is correct, and he did not do anything that would jeopardize the fund. He paid the full $87,000 or so that the fund was due to the fund. That was a discharge of all obligations pursuant to the contract. But nothing in the contract said that he, and we know that this, the Common Fund Doctrine operates outside of ERISA, this Court's precedents repeatedly say so, that he then proceeded to ask for attorney's fees under the Common Fund Doctrine.
And at the time he signed that subrogation agreement, did he intend to eventually bring suit against the carpenters, or is that in the record?
That would be speculation on whether he would have to sue. He certainly contacted them, indicated under state law the fund was obligated to pay him for what he recovered for them, a contingency fee. He attempted to negotiate with them. The plan refused to negotiate. But one thing you have to look at is that provision in the plan does not obligate the attorney not to seek attorney's fees.
But it certainly makes it clear that the plan is not obligated to those fees for the recovery of funds.
Well, it's not obligated with respect to the beneficiary.
But it puts Mr. Dar on notice of that, and he signs off on that.
Right. And Mr. Dar spoke to his client about that. Now, the plan itself also indicates and anticipates that sometimes it may have to pay attorney's fees. And in such instances, one of their options is to deny future benefits to the beneficiary.
Or to recover those fees from the settlement.
They could, but they have discretion on how they remedy this.
Your client controls the settlement funds, doesn't he?
Well, he doesn't after he's paid it to the plan. He paid it to the plan.
But the other funds. I mean, if there are fees over and above what are paid, if the plan has costs in recovering those, the reimbursement, those could be recovered from the other settlement funds.
Well, those funds were paid to the beneficiary who was the plaintiff who settled. And so the beneficiary has those funds. In every instance in the past where these issues have come up, the fund has had recourse, if it chose, and it has the discretion again to do so, against the beneficiary. And that's a crucial distinction here, because the plan itself, in their brief to this court on page 5, concedes that this was merely an acknowledgement of the obligations that Miller had. Moreover, on page 5, coincidentally, of the court below's opinion, document 33, the court states that the only person who received valuable consideration here was Miller. There was no consideration at all to Dar, so therefore he was not a party to what Illinois law regards as a quasi-contract. We also know under Illinois law from the Schultz decision that Illinois law says that contracts that disclaim the attorney fee, the common fund doctrine, are unenforceable. And so therefore there is the issue of whether this contract, at least as to that provision with respect to Dar, was enforceable at all. This court acknowledged that in Varco and acknowledged it again in Cruz. And so, therefore, it's possible that they have no recourse in Illinois law against Dar at all or against Mr. Miller. And so, therefore,
So why would the plan ever exercise its discretion to advance medical expenses to someone in an injury situation?
Because that's the only way they will ever get any recovery at all. Obviously,
they don't pay it out. They don't have to worry about recovery.
Well, then there's no reason for a plan in the first place.
They're not obligated. It is discretionary, would you agree, for the plan to advance those fees?
But this court recognized in Wells that it's in the long-term interest of the plan to pay the attorney's fees because there's otherwise no incentive to go after the third party who is liable. And obviously, the only reason for a plan to exist is to pay these kinds of benefits. And the ERISA statute is supposed to be interpreted for the beneficiary's benefit, not to protect the plan against the beneficiary. Its whole purpose is to make sure that beneficiaries do receive what they bargained for. And here they bargained for medical expenses. Those medical expenses were repaid. There was a windfall to the plan. And the attorney simply asked for, under valid state law, his appropriate fee.
So what if the plan hadn't been paid back?
If the plan hadn't been paid back, and
would Dar still get his fee?
Well, what we saw in several of the cases is Varco's a good example. In Varco, the attorney withdrew his fee off the top. Mm-hmm. The beneficiary then went to court to try and deny having to pay back the part that included the fee. This court found that he had no standing to assert the attorney's rights because that's a personal right to the attorney. The attorney owns the cause of action. But indicated that if the attorney had been still part of the cause of action, the results might be different. And so, therefore, it left open several questions about whether there is a preemptive effect to the document against the attorney, noting, among other things, that the federal common law, common fund doctrine, might override the provision in the plan, as well as this provision of Illinois law that I mentioned, where these contracts are regarded as unenforceable, and I would urge the court to consider the similarity to this to the Federal Arbitration Act. Under the Federal Arbitration Act, state law defines whether there's a contract, and if there is a contract, then the arbitration provision is enforceable.
I guess what I was getting at, doesn't it seem a little unfair that if the plan hasn't been repaid, then the attorney just takes their cut off the top? But if the plan has been fully repaid, then the pension fund or the fund has to just come up with what would essentially be fresh money to pay that.
I think this is part of the way the statutory scheme is set up. The plan itself has a first and priority lien. The funds are held by the attorney under the statute in a constructive trust for the plan. So I think there is an absolute obligation on the part of the attorney to pay the fund back in full and then request payment for the recovery he obtained for the fund. I think the statutory scheme requires that. So I would think that the attorney did something that was improper in the Varco situation by taking it off the top like that. But as I point out, Darden received no consideration for this, and so therefore there is no way that he is considered a party, a beneficiary, a fiduciary under the plan so that the plan could be enforced against him. And this Court's repeated holdings in case after case acknowledge that, because if indeed he was a party to the plan, then there would be no bar against removal. Then indeed there would be a federal right at issue. And so therefore I would submit that to all these court cases that this Court has decided, Primax and Blackthorne and Lehman, would be wrong. But they're not wrong, because the recourse, if any, exists against the beneficiary, who is the party to the plan and who engaged in what Illinois law regards as a quasi-contract. Now, I see I've run into my rebuttal time, and I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Robertson?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jim Robertson, counsel for the trustees of the Carpenters Health and Welfare Trust Fund of St. Louis. The facts in this case are simple, and I'm not going to bother you with them again. I think the briefs are fairly straightforward, but there are some things in the reply brief that I would like to address, if I may. There is a statement in there that the first time that the NREM issue was raised was in the briefing, and that's not true. It's in count two of the complaint. There has been some discussion of whether or not anyone can hold Mr. Darr accountable for the money that came into his possession. And the next step, of course, is whether he would be liable to the fund by virtue of having signed the subrogation agreement. The Longaberger case out of the Sixth Circuit says post-Siriboff, the equitable lien in favor of the plan, and we have a provision that's virtually identical with the provision in that case, attaches to all of the settlement funds, wherever they might be, if we can find out who got them. This Court in Gouda, I believe, which is also post-Siriboff, addressed the issue of the equitable tracing and said that's not really necessary anymore. You just have to go find whoever got this money. There's also been a great deal of effort made to describe this as the removal of a Section 514 conflict claim. I think a fair reading of Count 2 and Count 3 of the complaint make it clear that those are Section 502 ERISA claims. The plan stepped into court to enforce the terms of the plan. Mr. Peck mentioned that the Section 1132 or 502 of ERISA permits actions for benefits under the fund, actions for injunction to prevent violations. He forgot that the tag end of that section says to enforce the terms of the plan, and that's what this case is about. That 502 action could not be brought in state court. Indeed, I believe it's Iowa Healthcare versus Graham where that issue was addressed at the district court level. The probate court had adjudicated liens, and the district court said that under Illinois law, if the plaintiff chooses the forum, you don't have a res judicata effect where the defendant has a counterclaim that cannot be raised in that forum, and that's exactly the situation that we had. If you follow that Graham case, we could have gone forward, litigated the state court action, and then gone to federal court, asserting our 502 rights in an entirely separate lawsuit, which would be a lot more expense, a lot more time.
Could that suit be against just the Millers, or could Darr be a defendant in that?
Under the Longaberger case, Your Honor, it could be brought against Mr. Darr to the extent that he received a piece of the settlement fund. There are cases that say that an attorney has responsibility by virtue of just representing a beneficiary. I happen to think they're wrong. There's a district court case in Chicago that says that Illinois professional rules impose that. I don't think that's right, because you do have a duty of undivided loyalty to your client. But if you sign the subrogation agreement, that's a different story. And there is also case law on that issue. However, we never got there. Count two and count three were dismissed before we could get to the briefing, before we could submit all of this authority, because the court saw fit to enter an injunction to prevent further proceedings in state court and to deal with all of the issues between these parties, Mr. Darr, the Millers, and the fund, in the district court in the Southern District of Illinois.
So that's why you never got to argue using the subrogation agreement.
Well, that's
that
it, Judge.
He's stopped from bringing the action.
Essentially, that's right, but we never got there because Judge Herndon entered the injunction, and we think that's correct under the fact that there's in rem jurisdiction here, and they say, as I mentioned, that that's the first time we mentioned it. That's pled in count two of the complaint. And my understanding of the law is that if the district court is correct, even though it may or may not give the wrong, the correct reason, that it, that stands up. In addition to that, not only could we not adjudicate those, but there's a lot of discussion about injunctive relief. There's a split of authority there, too. But the basic test is if you have a uniquely federal cause of action which can be given its intended scope only within the federal court, it requires a stay. They cite an Illinois bar journal that they describe as respected that says if the plan refuses to pay, you should file a lien adjudication action in state court. The Graham case says the state court has no jurisdiction over that issue because of the 502 claim.
Well, let me ask you, what's the outer limit of where something becomes an ERISA case because it happens to touch on an ERISA plan in some way?
I don't know the answer to that question. This court has observed that there's kind of a fuzzy line out there, but Judge Scalia, and I think it's Sereboff, says it's clear that ERISA preemption is triggered when state law or a state cause of action is contrary to the terms of the plan. The terms of the plan in this case are clear.
Well, let's take this example. Let's say the plan builds in a provision that says all lawsuits against the plan, all claims made against the plan, must be adjudicated in federal court, and the plan gets you into a rent dispute, and the landlord sues the plan in state court. Can you then get an injunction like the one you got here to enforce the terms of your plan?
As I argued in the district court, no. Mm-hmm. That's not an ERISA matter. That's not a 502 claim. You can't do that.
And so how is Mr. Darr's claim different?
Because he has the settlement fund in the form of the attorney's fees that he harvested, because what he's trying to do is say that I owe you money, I'm going to pay you, and then I'm going to take it back, which, as Judge Herndon said, is a distinction without a difference, because he induced the plan to advance the benefits by signing the subrogation agreement.
So your injunction was to enforce your theories under counts 2 and 3.
Absolutely. We pled that if the court saw fit not to enter the injunction, then go ahead and give us a declaratory judgment, construe the terms of the settlement trust, which is established and referenced in count 2. That's the settlement funds. Construe the terms of the plan asset trust, which is in count 3. That's the trust that advanced the benefits to Mr. Miller in reliance upon the very thing that occurred would not happen. And that's a serious problem for us because we're trying to protect 37,000 covered individuals. It's not just this one case.
Well, here's another hypothetical. What if an ERISA plan said that plan trustees could trespass onto your property to recover benefits whenever they wanted, and they did, and then the beneficiary sues in state court for trespass? Would that be an ERISA suit? Could the plan sue to enjoin?
No. I also think if that's criminal, I believe there's an exception in ERISA from that, but we're getting way away from the core of my claim, which is that we have a 502 right to enforce the terms of the plan. If, in fact, you're talking about a core ERISA issue, and the issue here is we paid benefits in reliance upon some commitments that we weren't going to have this problem, we advanced them from the trust. The plan specifically excludes paying benefits for this kind of an incident under paragraph 25 of the exclusions unless everybody fully complies with the terms and conditions of the plan. We're trying to stay out of these problems.
And that everybody, does the plan include the attorney for the beneficiary?
Candidly, yes, Your Honor, and candidly, we've made improvements to the subrogation agreement in an effort to try to continue to better protect the interests of the plan, and yet, I have about $500,000 worth of subrogation matters on my desk where people have signed the agreement, said we'll abide by this, we want our client to get his medical benefits advanced, and as this court observed in Varco, that's a trade-off that many beneficiaries would gladly make, the certainty of the bills being paid at the front end versus the attorney fee issue. The alternative is to sit back and say, after you file your lawsuit, after you get a recovery, if there's anything left for which the medical providers haven't been paid, send us the bills and we'll pay them. I don't know how long it takes in Illinois, but in Missouri, that could leave somebody out there 3 or 4 or 5 years before they even have a chance to get their medical bills paid.
And so you're saying that the language now in the subrogation agreements are different than
It's better in the sense that it says that the attorney agrees not to disperse any funds without everybody agreeing to it, and that kind of locks them up. And we have people that refuse to sign it because they want to do exactly what happened here. And that's too bad for their clients. We'd prefer to pay the bill and not have these disputes and get reimbursed where it's appropriate and take care of all these other people who have been injured, have present medical bills, and maybe a prospect of future recovery. The classic case is where the insurance limits are less than the medical bills. They get a good deal out of that. We ultimately recover the insurance policy, but we pay way more than that. We're not a profit-making institution. We're trying to protect the corpus of the trust for the benefit of the beneficiaries, and I believe the comment was made that the sole purpose of ERISA is to protect the interests of the beneficiaries, but that's a whole lot more people than Mr. Miller. There's something like 17,000 active carpenters and another 19,000 or so retirees and dependents, and we're trying to protect all of them. And the only way we can do that is conserve the money to pay the bills in the future.
You made reference to that Illinois Bar Journal article, and I want to touch on that relative to the finding of Dar's conduct as not being substantially justified or taken in good faith. Given that there was literature out there essentially directing Dar that this was obviously this has been a heavily litigated issue for years. This journal and other commentators suggest that this is the way to go, the way to try to retrieve that fee. Doesn't that cut against the determination that it was in bad faith?
In a vacuum, it does, Judge, but if you look at the exhibits to the complaint, we went to great lengths to communicate to Mr. Dar exactly what the law is in this area, and I submit that it's settled under VARCO because the court said it's preempted. And then the question is, when is that ultimately going to get resolved? We think this case is VARCO plus because I don't find any evidence in the district court opinion regarding the injunction in VARCO, which was granted, and that was after some procedural manipulation where we went straight to court. I don't find anything in the summary judgment decision that says in the VARCO case the attorney signed the subrogation agreement, which is why I refer to this as VARCO plus.
Well, when you look at the VARCO language, though, VARCO did mention this possibility. This is a direct quote from Case. If the lawyer in the case had not compensated himself fully and as a result still had a stake in the action based on the outcome of the case, then the district court could have properly characterized the action as one by an attorney to enforce his rights and therefore appropriately brought by VARCO under Illinois state law. So we're talking about the question of whether or not these fees should have been awarded against Dar, and don't you think there's some comfort that Dar can take in that language, in that VARCO case?
Well, Judge, in the abstract, I'd say yes to that. But what we have here is a situation where the attorney induces the fund to move forward with the advance of benefits, and even in those jurisdictions such as Missouri and Arizona, where the courts say you have an undivided duty of loyalty to your client, and we're not going to find you liable. I see my lights on. I hope I've got enough time to answer this. We're not going to find you liable to the fund merely because you come into possession of settlement assets, because that would impact that undivided duty of loyalty. The Eighth Circuit specifically, and I don't remember if it's the Cossie case or the Ford case, but again, that's a count two issue, which is why we didn't get to it, says, however, in finding no liability, they say, however, if you sign the subrogation agreement, you are liable to the plan under ERISA. And we are here today in a case where the attorney signed the agreement for the express purpose of inducing the plan to advance benefits, and then turned around and said, now that you paid, I didn't really mean it. I have a major problem with that. The fund has a major problem with it because it gets us into these situations, and the solution will wreak havoc with the people that we protect who don't have insurance proceeds from somebody coming for their medical bills, or they may have enough, but it's not going to cover all the expenses. If we have to sit back and withhold benefits in order to protect the trust from this kind of conduct, we have a major problem on our hands. Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Robertson relies heavily on the Longaberger case and a number of other cases in which the attorney never paid the trust. And as a result, because he holds a constructive trust for the plan, his obligation to pay that trust, the amount due to the trust, is something that becomes an ERISA issue and is something that's subject to federal court. Here, that's not the facts. Mr. Dar owes the plan nothing.
I couldn't tell from the record. Did the trust actually cash that $29,000 check?
Yes. Well, there's no dispute that the fund has been fully paid back. There's no dispute that Mr. Miller owes nothing to the fund at this point. The only question that's raised in the state court action is whether the fund owes anything under the common fund doctrine to Mr. Darr.
Why don't you address his argument that, you know, the fund was induced into signing the subrogation agreement with the idea that attorney's fees would not come out of that, and somehow this, you know, was a...
It's not as though Mr. Darr wrote this agreement asking the fund to supply medical benefits to his client. It's his client, as a member of the Carpenters Union, had the right to seek benefits, asked the fund for it. The fund gave him a document that says, I, James Miller, and all the obligations are on the part of James Miller. And at the end it says, have your attorney sign it.
Are you saying that subrogation agreement is in conflict with the terms of the plan?
No, I'm talking about the plan itself.
Yeah, it conforms. The agreement conforms with the plan, doesn't it? That is, it's discretionary for the fund to advance those medical fees and can put those obligations on it under the plan.
On the beneficiary, yes.
Right.
And at the end of the plan document, there's a line for the attorney to sign, not specifically Mr. Darr, but an attorney, and acknowledges his client's obligations. Doesn't place any obligations on him. And, as I said, page 5 of the appellant's brief concedes this, that that's the purpose of this acknowledgement. It's not an inducement, it's not an incentive, and it's certainly not consideration to Mr. Darr. So, if we look at that, and we look at it in terms of the Anti-Injunction Act, then we also find that there's no REM here. They have the funds. There's no REM. They simply are obligated to pay attorney's fees. That's not part of a REM. And so, therefore, the only question is this something that was expressly authorized by the ERISA statute? The statutory provision says that you may enjoin acts or practices that violate the statute or the plan. That doesn't refer to state court proceedings. That's not express authorization. And the bulk of authority, as Wright and Miller point out, is that there is no such authority. And if you read Chick Kamchoo, the U.S. Supreme Court case, even an important federal right that has preemptive effect is not grounds for an injunction. So right in that context, there was no authority on the part of the court here to enjoin the state court action. Instead, it had to be adjudicated through the state court system, which is fully competent of determining federal law. And so, therefore, there was no jurisdiction before this court. It was improper for them to enjoin this action, and it was also improper for them to award attorney's fees in something that was clearly taken in good faith, in which there is substantial case law supporting Mr. Darr. And so we ask that the trial court be reversed, both as to the injunction, so that the state court proceeding may continue, because, again, Mr. Darr is not a party to the plan document. It's somewhat similar to the fact that parties to a contract cannot convey subject matter jurisdiction to a court unless the court already has.
Doesn't Mr. Darr kind of throw the Millers under the bus if you prevail on that? Because then the Millers immediately.
Well, as I said, I think Mr. Miller has some appropriate defenses in this case. But they have discussed this, and Mr. Miller is fine because either way, whether the plan prevails or we prevail, someone is going to have to pay for the fact that there was a recovery.
If you prevail, the plan then goes against the Millers.
And as I said, I think he has some very good defenses, but he's also been fully informed.
So they could terminate his benefits.
They could, or he could pay them back, or we could find that the provision is not enforceable, as I said, the Schultz decision held.
Thank you, Mr. Peck. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.